Hey, folks, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. We've got a great conversation that touches on domestic and global politics and policy. I'm excited to welcome to the conversation my friend Tom Nichols. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic and a professor emeritus of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College, where he taught for 25 years. He has served as a legislative aide in the Massachusetts House and the U.S. Senate. He writes about international security, nuclear weapons, Russia, and the challenges to democracy in the United States and around the world. And he brings that knowledge and expertise to our conversation here on the Michael Steele podcast, beginning right after this. Well, everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. I am very happy to have this brother back in the neighborhood. One of the smartest guys I know. It's always been a joy to work with him over the years. And we're fighting the same good fight right now on behalf of, democracy and the American people who actually still give a damn about democracy. None other than Tom Nichols. Welcome to the podcast, baby boy.
It's good to be back with you, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I'm just going to put the little trade secret out on the street. So Tom was very appropriately dressed, folks, before the podcast began. I thought he looked good. He had a nice little relaxed collar on, but the man's old school and I love that vibe. So Tom, I'm so glad you got dressed up for me.
I was in beachwear, man. I had to show a little respect. I had to actually wear, something that wasn't just like coming right in off the sand. So
no, it's all good. So I I'm glad to have you back because I just been trying to put a pin, a button, a post-it on the environment we find ourselves in on a number of fronts. You've got the whole legal thing going on. You've got with Trump and all of that. You've got Ukraine, which is sort of bubbling up, and certainly Republicans making a lot of noise there. The Biden administration is trying to sort of claw some space where people focus less on his age and more on his accomplishments. How are you assessing where we are as this 2024 cycle begins to unfold? We're here at the beginning of it in the fall of 23, knowing that there's a full year away from, where real action will begin. But it seems to be setting a pace that I think is a little bit different from what we've seen in the past. How do you assess where we are right now?
I like the line from that movie, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
Yes.
I can't, there's a lot of things going on that I just can't get my head around where, it's like invasion of the body snatchers. I'm running down the street saying, don't you see it? Don't you,
yeah.
And because it's like, oh, Joe Biden, at 3 years older than the sociopathic, violent seditionist running against him. And I'm going, what? Again, if you want to make the argument that Biden's too old, make it, but then write the same articles about Donald Trump, which no one does. And Trump, it's interesting. Again, the crazy pills feeling is, well, Biden stumbled. He said he had a gaffe because, of course, Biden has been for all of his career this kind of Roman candle of gaffe.
Right, exactly.
That's Joe Biden. It's just, but okay, the guy, he's 80 years old. And so sometimes he kind of does that Reagan thing for a moment, or he's walking a little more. Okay, Donald Trump makes no sense at all.
At all.
He's literally like not capable of stringing together a sentence. He has to be helped down ramps. He completely can't follow the thread of any conversation.
Right.
And I just find myself saying, are we really going to do this again?
Yeah, I think we are. Dude, I think we are. I don't understand. And this is, I've been trying to put a spotlight on it when I get to talk about it on MSNBC. There is a larger percentage of Americans who, for whatever their rationale or reason may be, think that electing Trump again is good for the country, that somehow inflation is going to miraculously go down, that when Trump gives Putin to Ukraine, that that will not be the precipitating event for the next world war, that for some reason, all of these issues with Hunter Biden are going to be revealed. At the same time, all the issues around the $2 billion money grab by his son-in-law, somehow that's less important. I don't know what people are thinking.
We're living in two worlds. One is this world of, you know, normalcy, right? Where we say, well, you know, the president's son's got some criminal problems and that's kind of embarrassing. And, you know, it's kind of a Billy Carter.
Right.
You know, Hugh Rodham sort of embarrassment, kind of, you know, names, talk about names from the storied past, right? That almost seem quaint now. But then there's this other world where every possible violation of norms, every bizarre, violent, threatening thing is, well, you know, it's, what are you going to do? That's just how that guy is. And it is an immense double standard. And it is one the American people tolerate, I think, in part, well, for several reasons. I started to light off when you said inflation. Again, you know, one of those crazy pills moments where I get into this huge social media kerfuffle, right? Inflation's been plunging for months. People say, well, it's going in the wrong direction. Why? Apparently because there was like a half point bump in August that wasn't reported until September, as if that's how people were making that decision.
Right, exactly. Instead
of the historical record, which is that Americans tend to always think inflation is going up no matter what it's doing. You know, and I'm like, okay, even if you think it's going the wrong direction, it's 3.5%.
Thank you.
I mean,
so is this excuse making?
This is part of our age problem, right? Because you and I remember inflation in double digits.
Oh my God.
18%. And, you know,
yes.
But I think the normalcy bias is that there are millions of people saying, you know, if Trump's elected again, would it be so bad?
That's it.
And the problem is they can't envision how bad it's going to be. There's not going to be a Jim Mattis this time. There's not going to be a Rex Tillerson. There's not going to be a Gary Cohn. There's God help me that I can't believe I'm saying this. There's not even going to be a Jared and Ivanka this time. This will be a festival of criminal pardons, you know, where, I mean, I don't know, let your imagination go. With 50 senators and one vice president, say hello to Secretary of Defense Mike Flynn or something.
Right.
So and people aren't getting their arms around this because they think it's all because mostly the policy bureaucracy, and you know this from years in government, there are hundreds of thousands of people who work in the government who make sure that the bad things don't become really bad. Right. They kind of put all the childproof bumpers on all the sharp edges of everything. And so Americans have gotten used to the idea that, what could happen? I mean, when we were younger and there was a Cold War and, you know, oil shocks and real inflation and all that other stuff, Americans got a snootful of how bad it could be. It could be World War III. It could be waiting in line for gas. It could be literally not, you know, being able to afford chicken. I know that people are struggling right now with higher prices that were always going to be inevitable after the pandemic. But, you know, that I think you have a generation of people who have never really seen high inflation, high interest rates, high unemployment.
Right.
And certainly not happening all at the same time, which is what happened, you know, years ago. And so we've just fallen into this kind of comfortable notion of Biden, you know, Biden's hosting the reality TV show this year, but next year it might be Trump, and that could be more fun and interesting, and nothing really bad will happen.
It's the false equivalency, and it's something I think you kind of warned about in a great piece in The Atlantic, where you state that, quote, the failure of democracy in America will not look like a scene from a movie where some fascist in a black tunic ascends the steps of the Capitol on Inauguration Day and proclaims the end of freedom. Rather, it will look like a, quote, federal breakdown that returns us to the late 1950s in all the worst ways. That to me really speaks to what you were just saying. This failure of democracy will look like something that relates back to a time in the worst possible ways. Talk to me a little bit about that and what you were grabbing for when you wrote that in The Atlantic.
Well, I don't need to tell a black man that there was a time in America where the Constitution didn't function in some parts of this country.
This is true.
You know, I'm particularly pained and angered by this because, you know, I was talking with a friend who's an ambassador, and you know, I used to go to the old Soviet Union and Russia, and he was an ambassador, and a lot of, you know, ambassadors always work in a lot of dodgy places.
Right.
And he said, you know, we would come back the minute you got back. And I always felt this when I got back from the Soviet Union, you'd say, America's not perfect, but here I am. I'm home. This is an island of safety and stability.
Mm-hmm.
No matter where I go, I don't care if the plane lets me off in Atlanta or Los Angeles or Miami, wherever it is. I get off that plane, that blue passport says, yep, I'm home.
I'm home.
My constitutional rights. I'm safe. And everyone who has one of these blue passports is safe. I don't think, you know, we can feel that. I don't think even in 2023 we can feel that way anymore.
Right.
And
right.
I think people really have to internalize that, that, you know, you and I together driving from Boston to Los Angeles could have some misadventures, you know, as a white guy and a black guy driving, yep, across the country now, which is the way we would have thought about it in 1955. You know,
yeah,
if in 1955 you'd have said to my dad, hey, Michael and I are going to drive cross country, my father would have said, okay. You know, you guys, what route are you guys taking?
What route are you taking, right? Which way are you going?
And which I think that's going to be true for people of color. It's going to be true for women. It's already happening about, you know, why are you leaving the state, ma'am?
Yeah.
You know, are you going, who gave you directions to the neighboring state abortion clinic? I mean, this is insane. This is not America. And there won't be, and I added in the piece, there's not going to be a Justice Department that's going to step in. I mean, this will be a Justice Department that will make you nostalgic for the high-mindedness of Bill Barr.
Right. Right. And
there's not going to be a Pentagon or a Justice Department or an FBI that's going to step in. It's going to be a government of it's going to be a Caudillo-led kind of Latin American, you know, for my friends, everything, for mm-hmm. my enemies, the law.
The law. Right. Right. And that idea is the piece that I still fundamentally, when you put it in front of people, you ask yourself, why don't you see what I see? Are you so blinded by your tribalism and your belief that Trump and Trumpism is somehow better than democracy itself, that you now are willing to turn it all over because you think somehow, to your point a little bit ago, Tom, that you're going to be better protected than how democracy is protecting you right now?
I think their answer would be that is me getting what I want and living the way I want is democracy. And if you don't like that, and it means that your rights aren't protected, that's your problem. I think, excuse me, I think people always have to remember how aggrieved these people feel about everything.
Everything. Everything.
Just before we came on today, I was reading about this ridiculous movement in Eastern Oregon, right? We want to be part of Idaho now. Why? Because you're not getting your way on guns or...
Right, right.
That you're no
because
longer...
Because there are other people here who think differently than I do.
So I want to be part of a different set. Well, then move there. And what they're saying is, no, I like where I am. Let's just redraw the state borders so that I'm part of, you know, greater Idaho. What sort of childlike reasoning is it now to say democracy means that if things don't go my way, I'm going to take out a Sharpie just like Trump and I'm going to redraw the state
Well, we had that happen in Maryland. We had in Western Maryland, we had folks who lived in the Western parts of the state. A number of state legislators proposed, well, we want to be a part of West Virginia now. So why don't we're going to make an appeal to the West Virginia legislature to annex this part of Western Maryland. And the rest of us just laughed. We just, even the West Virginia legislators laughed because it is that ludicrous. But beneath the surface of it, Tom, is the rot itself, the poisonous rot itself. Because while we laugh at it today, in 5, 10, 15 years, it becomes a reality because enough people get poisoned by the rot.
And think of the underlying philosophy of this, which is, I'm an American. I believe in the Constitution and democracy.
But if
my state keeps abortion legal, that is so intolerable to me that I will trash all of that. That if my state puts limits on guns that I don't happen to like, that I literally cannot live in that state. And not only can I live there, not only will I not move, but I will demand that the entire state constitution and the American federal system be redone to my satisfaction. The idea that somehow you live among people that you don't agree with, and that every season of politics is another chance to make your case, to get people to vote the way you want them to vote, to make your argument. It's almost like I was talking with a friend earlier today who studies the Middle East. He said, it's almost like the Islamists of the 90s who are like, we're going to run for the parliament in order to put democracy out of business because democracy is evil, but vote for us so that we can take everything apart, so that we never have to vote again.
We don't have to vote again.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's childlike and dangerous at the same time. I mean, it really is a kind of political insecurity and immaturity that really is beneath us as a country. And I'll add one other thing. The media and a lot of folks, and we have got to be careful with saying that, because I mean, pointing fingers at each other, I guess.
I know, right?
It drove me crazy that the framing of that story was, well, a lot of people in Eastern Oregon feel alienated now. And I'm like, did you go to Idaho and talk to liberals? I'm sure they feel pretty alienated too, but I'm sure they're not trying to redraw the state. It's always, we talk to these folks on the far right in the Trump movement, and we study them like they're children, or like they're a tribe or something that we have to reach on it. We don't treat them like fully empowered Americans. We don't say to them, look, I understand things, there are things happening in your state and there are elections that didn't go the way you want them to. Well,
why do I have to explain that shit to them now? Why shouldn't I treat a 70 something year old man or woman who's acting like a petulant little child, because I'm not getting my way. I want y'all to do what I want you to do, and I want you to believe what I want to believe.
There's no way my guy lost that election.
He didn't lose that election. No, he did not. And therefore, because I said he didn't lose, he didn't lose.
Right.
So what the hell am I going to do? 70, 40, 20. I don't care how, if that's your attitude after living in this country through how many presidential elections and cycles, you come to 2020 and that's your attitude? I'm going to treat you like a petulant little 10-year-old because that's how you're acting.
It's interesting that so often I've been, and you and others, particularly in the Never Trump space, well, you're looking down on these folks, or you're condescending to them. I'm treating them like my fellow citizens who are fully capable of understanding the constitutional system of the United States.
Thank you.
I'm treating them like my fellow Americans, grown men and women who are capable, because one of the things that really drives me crazy is when people say, they don't understand and they haven't followed the news, or they only watch Fox. And I'm like, that's not an excuse.
I'm sorry.
Is not an excuse. That is not an excuse for being a bad citizen.
Bingo.
And we all have a duty. We all have a responsibility to be citizens and to treat each other with respect instead of, you know, calling up election officials and threatening to kill them.
Right.
Which is just psychotic at this point. I mean, there's a kind of mass psychosis, I think, on the right, you know, that really has become, you know, again, we've kind of coddled it. And I mean, this is why I'm so glad to see, you know, the guys on January 6th getting 20 years. So, you
That's
know,
it.
I'm sorry. You can't just stand there and say, well, I was misled. Well, okay. But now you're going to have a lot of time to think about it.
Now you have a lot of time to think all over it, which now the coddling piece is the next side of this I want to get into, because that brings me to the events of this week, where you have Marjorie Taylor Greene, along with Matt Gaetz, basically bitch slapping Kevin McCarthy so damn hard that he goes in front of a bank of microphones and declares, I'm directing the committee of fill in the bucket of shit to go out and begin to look at how we can make some more shit up on Joe Biden, slather him all in it, and then impeach him, even though I know there's no vote to do that, because while I said a week ago I wouldn't do this without taking a vote, my members have basically told me, oh, there's no vote, so now I'm just going to direct it. So this coddling crap that we see from the likes of McCarthy has now led us to the point where the idea of impeaching a president is no different than the idea of, I don't know, just making shit up and throwing it at him.
You know, talk about strange bedfellows, right? I mean, one of the people that I normally wouldn't have thought that I'd be kind of nodding along with, but Ken Buck of Colorado. I mean, no one's going to accuse Ken Buck of being a weak sister or a squish or liberal. And here we are kind of amazed that this very right-wing congressman stands up and says, I'm not doing this. This is bullshit. There's no there. But it shows you how unserious and how unserious we are as a people, as a government, but also how insulated from consequences everything has become. Because it's like, well, okay, we'll impeach the president, you know, it's just part of the game now, right? I mean, it's just part of the thing. And why are we doing it? Because Kevin McCarthy cannot endure the notion of life
as not
being the Speaker of the House.
Cannot do it.
And so for that, instead of, you know, I was going to say the other person we're looking back at, boy, this kind of makes you miss the courage of John Boehner, right? It's like, okay, fine, you know, I won't be speaker anymore. I mean, that looks like Fort Apache now, man, you know. And instead, yeah, this guy says, oh, you want me to do something crazy and irresponsible and damage, you know, the constitutional order of the United States? Well, okay, because, you know, because conspiracy theorists and complete, you know, edge cases are now telling me that I won't be speaker if I don't do this. And instead of saying my legacy will be that I will be the speaker who put a stop to this, that I stood for the Constitution, that I obeyed my oath, that I stood in the doorway of the House and I said, not this time, not again.
Yep.
Instead, he says, I got to be speaker. It's a nice office and, you know, the food's good and I like Washington. I mean, I always wonder,
and I drive around in a black car.
I mean, my constant hammering on Elise Stefanik, you can say whatever you want to me, but I'm not going back to upstate New York.
That's it.
You know, I really think that's so. People used to say, well, you know, this is just you guys. But hey, Mitt Romney said it out loud of they like being in Washington.
They don't want to go home.
They don't like their own constituents. They're afraid of their own constituents.
And what did you think of the Mitt Romney news this week in contrast to what we're talking about now with Kevin McCarthy? I thought it was sort of the sort of perfect yin and yang kind of moment in politics to watch Kevin McCarthy squirm on the pike of his own conviction and to have Mitt Romney stand up and say, check, please.
Yeah,
I'm done. I cannot even pretend anymore.
And I think it's really, unfortunate that a lot of people took that opportunity to say, well, you know, oh, sure, now you speak up, Mitt, or, you know, you didn't do enough, or why are you leaving? You should fight. Guy's 76 years old.
Yeah.
And yeah. has been paying, shelling out $5,000 a day for security for his family in Utah, mm-hmm. in a place where his family, you know, was once really well thought of, where he was popular.
Yeah.
In a place that prides itself on its niceness and its, you know, neighborliness, a place that was a role model. I mean, I wrote a book recently where I pointed out that in the 1950s, there was a social science text that pointed out St. George, Utah as like the apotheosis of the civic American ideal.
Mm-hmm.
And here's Mitt Romney, you know, well-known conservative Mormon senator saying, basically, I got to pay for security guards.
I got to pay for security because otherwise these mofos going to kill somebody in my family. And we've already seen that narrative play out with Nancy Pelosi and her husband. And yet, you know, the hue and cry and the lesson was not learned by the unfortunate shooting of Steve Scalise at a congressional baseball game. You would think that that galvanizing moment would focus their attention on how fragile their security is as a member of Congress in this environment. Oh, no, wait. Oh, January 6th. Oh, where they wanted to hang the vice president and they crapped all over the desks of members of Congress and they were roaming the halls looking to find a member so that they could beat the living shit out of them. These self-same Republicans don't appreciate that enough to recognize why someone like Mitt Romney steps aside or why other Republicans are saying, I don't want to play anymore. Time out. This isn't worth it to me.
You know, it's interesting when you brought up Scalise, I thought one of the things you were going to say is that it was also a moment where everybody all around could have said, you know, maybe we ought to stop using rhetoric that's going to instigate the least stable people among us.
That's right.
Words have consequences. And we all get it that if we use certain kinds of words, 99.99% of the people in this country understand that it's just political rhetoric and that we're throwing grenades at each other and that we're getting a little out of hand. But what we're learning, particularly in the age of social media and in the age of, you know, rapid communication, is that there's going to be a 0.001 out there who says, you know, I have to go kill a congressman.
Yeah.
And it's just not sobering anybody up to, we grasp onto these great little moments. I mean, Joe Biden and Rick Scott in Florida for one 30-second window, everything felt normal. Thanks for being here, Mr. President. Glad to help, Senator. Going to help the people of Florida. Appreciate it. You know, with that,
but the governor couldn't show up.
The governor, well, he was off, you know, threatening to bomb Mexico somewhere.
Right.
Because, I mean, it's just, if it weren't so dangerous, the word I would use more often is it's inane. It's just inane, but it's also dangerous. And I think we just can't seem to kind of grow up and be adults and to say, you know, we have to get along with each other. We have to solve problems together. Nobody cares about that. They care about, and I think, you know, I'm not going to both sides this because I think it is almost entirely now on the American right of saying, I don't want to go home and live among my constituents. They scare me.
No, it is entirely among the American right.
And by the way, that was the thing when I didn't mean to interrupt, Michael.
No, go ahead.
Talking about comparing Romney and McCarthy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's McCarthy going, I was standing there with this hostage video, basically, that I shall direct, you know.
Right, right.
I mean, he could have been saying, like, I am directing my bank to transfer $1
million
to the kidnapper's account in Switzerland, you know. and instead he stands there and he goes through this utterly, you know, this utter cowardly nonsense about impeachment. Whereas, you know, here's Romney saying there are guys walking up to him and saying, I totally agree with you and I really want to help, but I fear for my life. I fear for my family.
So, okay. So you've opened up that little door for me and I'm going to put both my feet into it because you've had this conversation. I've had this conversation. Romney talks about it in a way that just sort of, at least for me, animates exactly the experience. When you have these people who come to you and say, you know, I couldn't say what you just said.
Boy, I wish I said
that. I couldn't. Why not? Why couldn't you just say Donald Trump is full of shit? Okay, moving on. So how much does your world change? Let me get this straight. You mean to tell me your position as a Republican member of Congress or the Senate is so fragile, your ego is so intertwined with it, that this is the only thing you can do in your life ever, full stop, that if it ended tomorrow, you would be nothing but the pile of shit you're showing yourself to be at this moment by saying to me, I wish I could say what you said, just said?
I don't, you know, the first big job I ever had was after grad school, I had a tenure track job, right? You know,
right.
And I kind of figured out a couple of years in, I said, this isn't going to happen here. You know,
read the room.
I read the room. And also, you know, I kind of brought it on myself. I mean, you know, what a get along, go along guy I am.
Right.
But I, you know, I remember thinking, well, you know, I'm almost 30 years old. I had a life before this. I'll go on. I'll do another thing. Everybody in America makes that calculation about a job. And I'm not special. You know, everyone who's ever had a job says, well, if I lose this job, I'll have to get another job. I'll do something else. Members of Congress, that's like they can't even parse that idea.
Nope.
But the other thing I think that's so striking about that is that there were people, the hangers-on, the people that became, you know, the anti-Trump people, the people in the conservative media, you know, the people who decided to become the Fox primetime lineup.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of them could have said, hey, I don't have to say anything. I don't have to go that road, you know, as enthusiastically as I'm going. But they went. I mean,
they went, right.
You don't have to become Michael Steele, and you don't have to, you know, bloviate all day about this like Tom Nichols. You don't have to turn into Matt Schlapp.
Right.
You know, you don't have to turn into all these guys in the conservative ecosystem.
Or Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham.
Oh, but he's a special case. Let's face it, Michael. He's in a class by himself at this point. I mean, he is, you know, there's a whole, if you're talking about the whole genus of people who have become that, he is his own species at this point. You can't, I mean, I think, you know, God bless Will Salatin for plowing through that for, you know, 100 pages to kind of detail this profile in cowardice.
Yes. Yes. I think,
you know, there were all these other people who said, you know, I could say nothing. I could become a never Trumper. Okay. That's right. Got costs and I don't want to do that. But how about not becoming a super Trumper? And I think part of the problem is, and you know, this is something that I think in the past 7 years is I realize that we're plowing old ground by pointing this part out. But I think some of them early on said, I'll only have to double down once and then I'll be okay. And then I'm going to double down and double down. And at this point, I think they've done it so often they genuinely believe their own bullshit at this point. I think they've internalized it because they don't know how to live if they haven't.
We are having fun with my friend Tom Nichols. He is the staff writer at The Atlantic and a professor emeritus of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. He's one of the smartest guys out there. We haven't even gotten into the foreign policy stuff yet, folks, because that's what we're going to do when we come back with Tom Nichols right after this.
Hey there, this is Lee McGowan, but most people call me Politics Girl. You might know me from my award-winning rants, where I break down major political issues from my kitchen. But I'm also the host of the Politics Girl podcast. Each week, we discuss key issues that are affecting America and its people. We don't do the news, we do the big picture, what it means and why you should care. We break down complicated issues conversationally, so you can understand what's going on and be able to speak to it. Ultimately, the goal is to have you leaving the podcast feeling smarter than you came in. Listen to the Politics Girl podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your pods. I know your time is limited, so if you spend it with me, I'll make sure it's worth it. Politics Girl Podcast. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele Podcast. I am Michael Steele, and on board with me today is my man, Tom Nichols. You know him. You follow him on Twitter. You see him on MSNBC, and he is the stable genius.
Very stable.
I want to shift gears away from the domestic stuff, because I do at the near the end want to come back and talk a little bit about Dems and the dilemma that they perpetually seem to create for themselves in this moment of democracy, how mindlessly feckless they can be in trying to get something done. But this
how many times did, as Republicans back in the day, say we're going to count on that, right?
Right.
You know, they said, why are you so confident about this election? I said, well, you know, we're running against Democrats.
We'll be okay. So I do want to get your take on the developments in recent weeks on the planet, on the rest of the globe. Particularly with respect to China and Russia seemingly wanting to dance a little bit closer together, and the impact that could have not just in the Indo-Pacific, but certainly with respect to our engagement globally here in the U.S., as well as in equally importantly with Ukraine and the realities that are now getting discussed there about not only how that the issue of Ukraine was discussed, for example, in the GOP debates, and I discount a lot of that. But I think there is also sort of this underlying global thread with respect to Ukraine that seems to have an endpoint to it. We've been pulling it. And my feeling, Tom, is at a certain point, there's no more thread left, that we're out, that the garment has now been completely unwoven. And how that may play out for our European allies.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I think continuing to support Ukraine is part of America's role in the world.
I agree.
Leader of the free world. Yep. I mean, this is a struggling young democracy. It's a young state, like all of the post-Soviet states. It's a country that's been around for 30 years. And they're under attack from a country that isn't even making any pretense about imperial conquest. I mean, I think people don't realize that what Putin says about Ukraine is almost exactly the way Saddam Hussein used to talk about Kuwait. There is no such thing as Kuwait. It's the 19th province of Iraq. And
right.
We were all appalled by that. And Putin says, there's no such thing as Ukraine. It's not a state. It's not a place. It's just little Russia. You know, it's just a place that we owned and we will own again. And I think, you know, people kind of forget that because it's been so politicized that, how do you feel about Ukraine? Well, I'm a Republican, so I'm against it. I'm a Democrat. Thankfully, for now, a majority of Americans across the parties are still holding on to saying we have to do this. I am less concerned. You brought up Russia and China. I have always been less concerned about a Russia-China axis because it's been, I mean, you know that I got my start as a Russia guy. And
that's right.
Sovietologist back when there was such a thing. And people have been predicting the Moscow-Beijing axis for as long as I've been doing this. And what everyone seems to forget is that Russia and China hate each other at a fundamental gut level. They just hate each other. And it's amazing because they both kind of look down upon each other in this very racial way, you know, that the Russians sort of look down on these Asians and the Asians look down on these Slavs, you know,
right.
there's not a natural relationship there. Now, dictators, as they are wont to do, will reach out to each other and find common cause. But I think one of the reasons I'm less concerned about that is Putin has so screwed the pooch in Ukraine and has messed up so badly that the only way the Chinese are really going to agree to do this is to take Russia on as kind of this junior partner, which is just going to rub everybody.
As
the Russian high command is not going to love that. Putin's not going to, but it's right now the Russians just have to live with it. And I also think people have made way too much of this. CNN was just banging on about this for days, about this North Korean visit, to Russia with Kim Jong-un going and meeting Putin. Well, of course he is. You know, Putin's showing up with a tin cup in his hand saying,
right,
you know, we'll sing for artillery shells. You know, what do you got? But again, these are not countries that have natural interests with each other. These are not, and again, I will say international relations specialists, as much as I defend the expert community, the realists among us have always said, well, the Beijing Moscow thing is going to happen because, you know, if you look at the big risk map, you know, the game of risk and mm-hmm. the blue and the yellow and the red and the green. But culturally, again, those are two countries that just can't stand each other. So everything is a marriage of convenience at this point. What really worries me is that we Americans, I think, are always in danger of losing focus that the end of the Cold War does not mean that American democracy and not just democracy, but American interests in the world are always in peril.
Right.
Americans keep saying, so what? So the Russians win in Ukraine or the Chinese have a giant navy. That's something you can afford to say right now because the world runs on the Washington rules.
Right.
The Washington Brussels rules.
That's it. Right there.
When the Beijing rules kick in, and you're going to feel it. You're going to feel it not just in, you know, where you can travel and, you know, how many weapons are pointed at you. You're going to feel it at the supermarket. You're going to feel it at the automobile dealership.
True.
Everything that moves will move around the world at the sufferance and forbearance of the Chinese. And Americans have never lived in that kind of world. They've never experienced it.
Right.
And to try to explain to them that this could happen because, you know, the world created after World War II was created by the United States and its allies. They are the architects and guarantors of this world. And if they're not there, it could look a lot like a world before that time where things moved around if it was okay with the British or the Germans or
the
Japanese.
And let's extrapolate that out because I think that's a very, very important point. And apply that idea that we've never played by the Chinese rules. They didn't get to set the table we're currently eating at. We set that table along with our allies, but we were the lead partner in setting it. The same can be true when you're looking at democracy as a whole, this fascination with authoritarianism as if it's just a day in the park. And because you're on that team, you somehow are going to be the one of the key beneficiaries. That's not often how that plays out. You've never had to eat at that table. You've never had the experience of that. And you're discounting the experience of those who have lived in those under those regimes, who left those regimes at great peril to come here, only to have assholes here in America who barely gotten outside on their front porch in the world, now telling them, yeah, we want to do that.
We want to be like Hungary.
We want to be like Hungary.
Like Russia.
Yeah, you're going to be hungry like Hungary, baby. Trust me.
Or Turkey.
Or Turkey.
Like, well, I'm really bitched out about inflation. I'm sorry. Have you read a newspaper? Do you know what the Turkish economy looks like after Erdogan fired all the civil servants and said, we're not going to worry about, statistics. because what they really think is when they say, I want us to be like Hungary or Russia or Turkey, they mean because it'll piss you off.
Right.
And because I am unhappy with my own life and I want everybody else to be pissed off. So let's be like Turkey. And they don't realize that if they think they're pissed off now, wait till they find out that the people they hate nonetheless can still insulate themselves from the worst effects of that.
Yeah.
But they can't. I mean, this is one thing that has always struck me about Trump voters. They claim, I'm from these, you know, we live in these small towns that are being hit hard. Okay, but the policies you're advocating for are going to hurt you. They're not going to hurt people who live in New York City or San Francisco or Los Angeles. It's like, it's what's that is it the Buddhist line about, you know, anger is like drinking poison and expecting the other guy to die?
Right.
You know, and I think, you know, you were talking about emigres, Michael, and people who have seen these countries. I would be happy just to have conversations with people who have ever visited them. I mean, have you ever been? I say to, and it's interesting that the conversations we have with people on the right now are the conversations I used to have with people on the left. And they say, yeah. Well, Soviet Union's not so bad. And I'm like, have you ever been to a country where you're afraid to go to church? Where you're afraid to buy a newspaper? Have you ever been to a country where the International Herald Tribune is in a hotel, is kept under the table, and you got to grease the concierge to get a copy of it?
Yeah.
Because no one should have one of those where you are. And, you know, that was a conversation you used to have with kind of dumb liberal kids in the 70s and the 80s who, you know, just didn't know anything. And now you're having these with, as you say, 70-year-old adults who say, well, it wouldn't be so bad if this were Hungary. Wouldn't be so bad if this were Turkey. And it's like,
have you ever seen
a country like this?
You'll appreciate this, Tom. So taking your point you just made about the global part, I broke it down to a baseline local issue, because you know all the noise we've been making here in the U.S. Around burning books, critical race theory being taught to sixth graders. I don't know in what world that works, but okay.
I love the idea that so many people think sixth graders have college level comprehension. I mean, I want to know that school system.
When their mama and their daddy don't.
Wow.
So I'm sitting there and I'm talking to one of my redneck friends who's waxing poetic about the Dobbs decision and why it was good to have states now enforcing abortion rights, the pro-life agenda and pushing back against abortion rights, to protect the unborn child in the womb, and to make it harder for women to have abortion. And I looked at him, I said, so tell me what you're going to do when your 16-year-old daughter, who is going to school with a lot of very handsome young Black men, come home pregnant with one of their babies. Tell me what you're going to do. You know, how does that discussion happen in your household? Share me some thoughts on that, baby boy. And he got so pissed because he knew exactly what his reaction would be. There's no way in hell you're carrying that child. There's no way in hell you're bringing that Black baby into my house. So this is to your point. These folks have this idealized view of what they think their new policies and their new idea of America is going to look like and sound like and feel like. And they don't see themselves in it the way you and I know they will be in it.
I call that for years, even you know, long before this was a huge issue, I used to call that the poopsie exception. It's like, no, there shouldn't be any abortions of any kind. Now, if poopsie, on the other hand, if my poopsie, you know, because that's, look, and I don't want to be too mean about that because that's human nature.
Yeah.
You know, and my answer to that, I always wrestled with this. I wrote about this some years ago because I finally said in a piece, my mom's been dead many years, but I said she almost died from an illegal abortion.
Yeah.
And so I don't, you know, I'm stuck. I mean, on the other, you know, I was conceived out of wedlock, so I'm glad I'm here. On the other hand,
right,
the ability to get healthcare nearly killed my mother. So how about we not spend a lot of time trying to intrude in each other's lives to do this? And this is where it comes back to, what does it mean to be a conservative, right? To say,
right,
should the state be involved? How involved in your personal life should the state really be?
Yep.
And so when this went back to the states, well, hey, I remember some of my conservative friends, Tom, they're just sending it back to the states. Okay, well, Kansas is going to put it in the Constitution. No, we didn't mean like that. You know, and that's part of why I called this court an activist court. They weren't sending it back to the states. Alito and the rest of them were sending it back knowing exactly, or thinking they knew,
right,
exactly what the states were going to do. And now, you know, in Ohio and Kansas,
and other places,
they've gotten a real, you know, bucket of cold water in the face.
And which is why they've now we need a federal ban, right? Now we'll put the federal government in play, as opposed to the individual states. And that is part of the problem.
Let's send it back to the states. Oh, let's take it away from the states.
The states, right.
Now, this is a very convenient and flexible federalism because it's not conservative. I mean, none of this is conservative in any of the ways that you or I would have once understood that word. Again, and I think a lot of the people involved, I will say that I think some of them are sincere. And if you ask them, I wrote this yesterday talking about Romney. I said, I don't mean Romney holds this view, but the people who are so agitated about this, I said, you know, I'm sure there are people that if you put it to them as a stark choice, you can have completely outlaw abortion or overthrow the Constitution. They'd say, okay, fine, the hell with the Constitution. I'm going to choose outlawing. Right. I'll take theocracy over democracy. But I think most of these people, again, are just saying, why am I, you know, pushing for this? Because it pisses off and enrages people that I've just learned to internalize to dislike in a way that didn't used to be there 30 years ago, because we weren't constantly, you know, people in Ohio weren't constantly asking themselves, well, what do they think in San Francisco? I sort of miss the days, you know, the early days of conservatism that I remember anyway, the early Reagan revolution, you know, people in Kentucky said, or Indiana or Maine or wherever said, you know, I don't really care what people in New York City think.
Right.
You know, there used to be that day, right?
There used to be that day.
Remember that, you know, and saying, well, and there was a great, and I am not, you do not in any way have to hand it to Jesse Helms. But there was a great Jesse Helms line, a great Jesse Helms story that I heard when I was working in the Senate for John Hines, where some staffer ran in and got all upset. And he said, Senator, the New York Times said this terrible thing about you, and I think we should write a response, and I'll, you know, draft it for you. And I guess Helms, in that old school of, you know, because he said, son, you want to do that? That's fine. He said, but I have to tell you something. I don't read the New York Times, and nobody I know reads the New York Times. And now we live in this kind of, you know, universalized internet-driven culture where you have people walking around, you know, Indiana saying, do you know what they did in California the other day?
Yes. Yes.
And it's like, okay, how about worrying about fixing Indiana? Man, you know, how about straightening out Springfield, Massachusetts, or, you know, Parma, Ohio, or something? I mean, when did this become a thing that we have to be at war with, you know, Gavin Newsom every day? I mean, it's just insane.
How do you, before I let you get up out of here, I want to get your thoughts. When you step back, and we joked about it a little bit before we went to break, but this idea that the Democrats right now, really should be writing a better narrative than they have. You're looking at numbers right now where people are sitting here. We talked about, you know, a 0.3 point uptick in inflation, and they think, you know, oh my God, you know.
It's like the Drudge Report sirens go off, right?
Right. I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? And then, you know, gas prices are, you know, always something that's going to go up and down, because when Saudi Arabia and fill in the blank country decide they want to have a cabal against the U.S., they do. And then when they've had enough of it, they don't. And the U.S. production goes up or down. So there's that. How do you assess how they're assessing themselves and their opportunity setting up for 2024?
You know, I've said this to a lot of my friends who are Democrats, as a guy that used to be, you know, on the other side of the fence, on the other side of the Berlin Wall there, I said, you have internalized Republican criticisms of your party, and you act on them. I said, boy, if we don't respond to a, you know, 0.3 percent uptick in inflation, we're going to get called elitist, and they're going to be mad at us. And it's like, first of all, they're going to be mad at you no matter what you do. Part of the reason the Republicans are banging this gong about inflation is they're trying to turn him into Jimmy Carter. They're trying to turn Biden into Jimmy Carter. And they're getting help from people on the left who always hated Biden, who are saying, see, he's bad for working people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the right answer to that is, I'm sorry, inflation at, you know, 3.5% after being at, you know, 11 during the overhang from a pandemic. Remember a year ago, people were saying, no way we're going to get a soft landing. No way. Big recession, gigantic inflation, collapse of the supply chain. You know, people run around their heart for. And now, you know, you get these articles that have these very timid headlines of, it looks like it could be a soft landing. But the problem is, if you say that, particularly in the binary world, I think Democrats are, I say this as somebody who's too online, but Democrats are way too online. They're afraid that if they say, hey, you know, the president guided us to a soft landing, people are going to scream, do you know how much eggs cost? And they've internalized that. They are frightened by it. They don't have that self-assurance. One of the reasons that the Republicans were so effective in the 80s, and you know this, you were there, is that there was this almost preternatural confidence and equanimity. You know, when Reagan would get out there and say, stay the course, and people would say, you hate the world. And he goes, yep. You know, that it's going to be fine. It's right. Morning in America. That takes a certain amount of, you know, stick-to-itiveness and some chutzpah, I guess. Democrats are terrified of the cases that are arraigned against them, and they take them on board and it gets inside their head. Again, you and I started this whole meeting, this whole podcast talking about this meeting like we're at a, you know,
yeah, funny, you know, that's the man, right?
He's like, you know, I know, right? It's like I don't live in Washington anymore, but
it's a meeting.
but we started this podcast by saying, you know, how is it that the old narrative is sticking to a guy who's like doing these international trips all around the world with plenty of stamina, but it's not sticking to the guy 3 years younger than he is who can't string two words together without sounding, you know, like a trauma victim. And yet, because the Democrats, and so there's all these Joe Biden should resign. Is he too old? What are we, you know, how can we get around this? Look, you know, run on the record and the chips will fall where they are. But the more that you adapt that those criticisms, the worse off you are. And I don't understand that lack of confidence. And I think in some ways this is, and now I'm going to say something very good about the Democrats and something very bad about the Republicans. That confidence to the nth degree was, I think, part of how the Republicans got where they are, of basically saying, you know, we don't care what anybody thinks and we're never wrong. But I think it's also the bad part about the Democrats that is kind of to their credit is, you know, every time one of our colleagues on the right says, these guys are fascists, the Democrats are going to take over, they're authoritarian. Listen, these guys couldn't organize a frat party couldn't organize a kegger in a brewery. Okay.
Right.
And that's part of their problem is that they just don't have that, you know, I'm sorry, I hesitated there because I went through about six metaphors before I got to one I thought we could use here. But you know what I'm saying? It's like they take these criticisms on board and they're not very organized and they don't know how to just say, hey, we believe in what we believe in too. And you're just wrong. And, you know, this Joe Biden's doing a good job and we're not going to sit around and, you know, twiddle our thumbs about this anymore.
Well, it's interesting because the way you've described that, and I had to go find this because I thought it was a perfect sort of illustration of the point counterpoint of how the Democrats are looking at this and how they're talking about Joe Biden. And more importantly, what they hear Joe Biden saying to them versus what MAGA Republicans hear Donald Trump saying to them. And a mutual friend of ours wrote recently in an email, and I don't know if you were on this particular email, but this is, I'm going to quote what he said. He said, quote, Trump promises to break everything and he delivers. He promises tax cuts for the rich and he delivers. He promises cruelty to immigrants, trans people, and protesters and he delivers. He promises to hate all the elites who ever looked down at him, the same elites who despise Trump voters, and he delivers. He promises trade barriers and a wall and to save us from nuclear war with North Korea, and he talks a good enough game to make enough people think he delivered. Now he's promising to punish all the people who hate him and his followers, to lock them up, to be their retribution. He promises to destroy the deep state. He promises to pardon the January 6th insurrectionists. He promises to hand Ukraine to Putin, wreck NATO, invade Mexico, and stave off an invasion of the southern border. And half the electorate thinks he may be a crook, but he does what he says he's going to do. For the first time in my life, there's no bait and switch. He's got a vision and he accomplishes what he says. I may not agree with all of it, but it's a relief not to feel like I'm being fooled again.
You know,
that America is the problem.
Those voters are enabled by just enough voters in the middle who say, yeah, none of that's going to happen.
Right.
So you have 30 or 40%, you know, maybe the floor, I don't know, 25, 30. I think it's somewhere around 35% who really believe all that. And they say, yep, that's what I'm voting for. And that's what I'm going to get. And I'm going to get the destruction of the Constitution. And I'm going to get jailing political opponents. And I'm going to get, you know, invading Mexico and summary executions of people that we don't like. I'm going to get all of that. The problem is that you have, and I've, a lot of them are my friends over the years trying to talk to them. They say, yeah, you know, but you know what? The economy is always better under Republicans, and that's not going to happen. None of that stuff's going to happen. Now, in 2016, you could have that argument, right? You could say, all right, I get it. We haven't seen what he's going to do. We don't know. A lot of it could just be bullshitting and bloviating and all of that stuff. How anyone in 2023 convinces themselves that this won't happen is the kind of denial that is going to just lead us to disaster. And those are the people that I've really run out of patience with in that sense. That, you know, I know it's supposedly, you know, we all hate Trump, but I don't. I mean, I have detached from them. My advice to other people is don't argue with them. There's no point. It's like arguing with cultists. You're not going to have this conversation.
Right.
The people I really get mad about are the people who say, yeah, I just don't think it's going to happen. Yeah, he's terrible and he says terrible things. And I don't really like him, but I don't know. You know, gas was $5. And that's that transactional kind of, I don't really think about things and I don't really believe anything bad could happen. And I'm just, all I care about is, you know, whether or not I filled up my SUV. That's where I think when democracy falls, it's not going to be the rabid kooks of January 6th. Who are going to enable it.
Right,
it's going to be the people who said, well, I just didn't think it would happen. And I was pissed off because gas was too expensive.
Ta-da. And that's why he's Tom Nichols. He nailed it right there. Tom, thank you, my man. I really appreciate you, brother, for coming on and sharing a word with us. This is an important time and we need those voices out there that are just coherently sort of laying it down. And you just put in very clear perspective what this boils down to. Those Americans who just sit there and think, it's just not going to happen until it does. And the reason they say it's not because they're selfishly looking at, oh, well, I'd pay a little bit more for gas. Or, yeah, Joe Biden says inflation is going down, but I don't feel it. And, oh, yeah, the unemployment numbers are low, but I know somebody who still hasn't gotten a job.
I know a guy.
I know a guy who knows a guy.
And the barista of, you know, the barista that served me my $7 coffee had a name of, you know, indeterminate gender specificity. Now I'm pissed off. I'm going to go to the big roulette wheel and hope that we end up on free instead of authoritarian. And I
have no stomach for it. I'm with you. I have no stomach for it. I have no patience for it. And I refuse to coddle it. I don't try to explain it. I'm beyond understanding it because I do understand it. And I just don't want to play that reindeer game anymore. So when people come up in my face telling me, you know, I just need to be, you know, nice or soft pedaling. Well, don't be so harsh and don't make them feel bad.
Talk to them.
Talk to them. Yes. No. You know, they'll listen. No, they won't.
No, they won't. People who should be listening are the ones who could be convinced and are just won't look up from the television long enough. And again, we'll, you know, too woke, too expensive. We're in real danger, and I think people are just haven't gotten their arms around that.
They haven't, and that's why I ask you to come on to help us begin to at least get some fingers and maybe a hand around it, because we're going to need all of that going into the cycle. Tom Nichols, great guy, does some great work at The Atlantic, and has written a number of very compelling books about global issues from his work in foreign policy. Well, you've got a book coming out soon. Are you working on something right now?
It'd be second edition of The Death of Expertise, which
at
this point, if people haven't read it, it's a book about why people don't listen to experts and are impervious to facts and prone to conspiracy theories. And there is a new edition coming out this winter, but at this point, it might have to just be like a annual volume or something. But yes, there is one more edition of The Death of Expertise.
Tom is telling the publisher, oh, no, we ain't done yet.
Just start numbering them with, you know, like the old Chicago albums, you know.
Right, exactly. Number six. Yeah. Tom, thank you so much, my friend, for coming on. Follow Tom on Twitter at Radio Free Tom. Is that also your handle over at the
Threads? And Threads? I'm trying to remember what I am on and Threads and Blue Sky. I am Radio Free Tom.
All right, excellent.
So you can find me there. And it was great to see you, Michael. It's great to hang with you. So
nah, man, it's always good when you're in the room. I appreciate it very much. And thank you for the conversation. It was very, very instructive on a number of levels. And I hope, folks, you got something out of it. And you really kind of pay attention, particularly at the end when Tom is kind of framing for you the space we're in now and why it's so dangerous when people just check out thinking that it won't happen. It's just not going to happen that way when it's already starting to happen that way. Tom Nichols, one of the greats. Thanks for being on with us. Folks, don't forget to do that download thing you do so well, because it's the kind of love a brother like me needs all the time. More downloads, please. It's like cowbell, you know? More cowbell, more downloads. It's not complicated. Love it when you do. Check out the podcast on Twitter at Steele_podcast, at Michael Steele on Twitter and X. Still Twitter. I don't call it X if you want, but still Twitter, but also on Threads. Until next time, be safe, be well. We're getting into fall. Things are cooling down a little bit. Still some trouble spots out there with some warm water stirring up some hurricanes. So stay away from that if you can. But otherwise, I look forward to seeing you next time here on the Michael Steele podcast.
Is it just me, or have we all lost our minds? It's a question more and more people are asking themselves, afraid to admit they already know the answer. It's also a podcast, one about people coming together in a time of division and uncertainty to talk about culture and politics, compromise and connections. It's about challenging the norms we've come to accept as a society and working together to find common ground. Fierce and unfiltered, host Jennifer Horn is a former Republican strategist and party leader turned independent sanity activist. One way or another, we've all lost our minds. Join Jennifer Horn in the search to find them again.